The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Reoccurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times column, Forbidden Tablecloth.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but doesn't the six-day creation story contradict the age of the Earth according to astrophysics and geology? A fair question, a very fair question. And you'd be surprised how often this question has come up lately. If you follow my program regularly, you've certainly heard me address it before. Well, today, we're going to back up, give it more detail, take a longer look at Genesis, not merely the obvious question of the age of the Earth, but other little things difficult to swallow, such as a talking snake. We'll get to Genesis during the second half of our program. Meanwhile, the greatest controversy of San Diego regarding Christianity has nothing to do with Genesis and everything to do with a cross on the hill. Now, I'm going to read to you from the Associated Press first week of January. Yes, this is a dated story. It had taken me a while to get to it. And of course, everybody and their brother has been asking me to get to it because it's kind of a natural for me. Reading from the Associated Press, January 4th. A war memorial cross in a San Diego public park is unconstitutional because it conveys a message of government endorsement of religion, a federal appeals court ruled Tuesday in a two-decade-old case. A three-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued the unanimous decision in the dispute over the 29-foot cross, which was dedicated in 1954 in honor of Korean War veterans. The court said modifications could be made to make it constitutional, but it didn't specify what those changes would be. In no way is this decision meant to undermine the importance of honoring our veterans, the three judges said in their ruling. Indeed, there are countless ways that we could and should honor them, but without the imprimatur of a state-endorsed religion. Federal courts are reviewing several cases of crosses on public lands being challenged as unconstitutional, including a cross erected on a remote Mojave Desert outcropping to honor American war dead. Tuesday's ruling could influence future cases involving the separation of church and state. Michael Aguirre, a former San Diego city attorney who has followed the case closely, said cross supporters will have to counter the court's analysis that the cross was used historically to promote Christianity. The ruling recounts that the cross was dedicated on Easter Sunday and used for religious gatherings for nearly three decades before it became a war memorial. It said La Jolla has a well-documented history of anti-Semitism from the 1920s to around 1970. Okay, since the beginning of the new year, people have been asking me to respond to this. Here is my response. And allow me to boldly depart from the conventional defense of the cross by responding directly to Aguirre. Let us go ahead and drop the war memorial part of the argument and admit that Mount Soledad displays a definite Christian symbol. Yes, it's also a war memorial, but yes, it's also a definite Christian symbol. Is it true that a federally owned cross violates our Constitution by specifically endorsing one religion with the usage of our tax dollars? The tax dollar argument, frankly, is growing tiresome. Let's be clear on this. Our earnings get used against our will for a multiplicity of items, and none of us approve of every distribution. My tax dollars, for instance, fund public schools and some public universities where the teachings contain zero compatibility with Christianity. Lectures about evolution abound. Theories of intelligent design are forbidden. And the Bible is often slammed as an inaccurate collection of documents with racist, chauvinist teachings, all untrue, but taught enthusiastically. by teachers paid for by the tax dollars of Christian American citizens. Lifestyles incompatible with Judeo-Christian values such as same-sex marriage, pro-choice positions are also encouraged. Supposedly, the Bible is a forbidden discussion at public schools unless someone wants to slam the Bible. Nobody ever says, hey, if we're not allowed to talk about the Bible, let's just not comment on it at all, either negatively or positively. As you see, this separation between church and state never cuts both ways. But then, why be surprised when the phrase separation between church and state is not found in our Constitution anyway? The words of the First Amendment simply read, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And boy, have we seen a lot of prohibiting of free exercise thereof lately, haven't we? Now, folks, the First Amendment does not mean that religion isn't endorsed. It means religion is not mandated. Our founding fathers actually did go out of their way to specifically endorse the religion of Christianity. No, we do not find the term Christian in the Constitution, but neither did its omission discourage the fact that our country was founded with a revolutionary war where the battle cry was no king but King Jesus. And when Christmas was made a national holiday way back in 1870 by President Ulysses S. Grant, citizens did not feel that their civil liberties were being violated or that the holiday contradicted the original intent of our Constitution's writers. When the First Amendment was written, colleges such as Harvard and Princeton were Bible colleges, and teachers led students through prayer in grade school. Christian symbols were found on public buildings all the time. The most ironic example, and as much as this seems to be mostly a court issue these days, being the Supreme Court building itself, with its engraving of the Ten Commandments on each door and figure of Moses on top of the building. None of this violates our Constitution. The First Amendment exists for freedom of religion and freedom from religion, but freedom from religion does not mean our government is not allowed to even remind you that religion exists, for Pete's sakes. If religious expression and religious endorsement are not constitutional, only one argument remains. Or they're not unconstitutional, as people would say it. So only one argument remains. The cross is offensive to certain atheists and other non-Christians. Yes, indeed. Free speech often offends. That's exactly why we have a Constitution. Why did the Constitution bother to protect free speech? If speech was always going to be some gentle, neutral communication that challenged nobody? America, grow up. Nobody is making you compromise your beliefs. If a cross on public display honestly meant that Christian citizens were to receive preferential treatment, I assure you I would be the first to protest. But that's not what it means. That's not what it means. And the idea that such symbols must be removed simply because some paranoid person doesn't understand the Constitution strikes me as a new low in the legal world, the intellectual world, and the world every one of us is watching disappear around us. Meanwhile, while people worry needlessly about Christianity taking over the country, there's a real honest-to-goodness attempt on the part of another religion trying to take over the world. Just a couple of weeks ago, a car explosion in front of Saints Coptic Orthodox Church in Alexandria, Egypt, killed 21 and injured 96 parishioners whose only crime was attending a New Year's Eve Mass. As icing on the cake, some enthusiastic Muslims stepped on the bodies while gleefully issuing forth jihadi chants. Sweet. And already the historical revisionists, without even giving this incident time to enter the history books, are blaming Israel. I'm reading from the Jerusalem Post, which is quoting from another journalistic publication. Mossad behind Egypt church blast, Iran's official television outlet, Press TV, said in a headline. All the evidence points to a Zionist plot, the article said. First, it goes without saying that no Muslim, whatever their political leanings may be, will ever commit such an inhumane act. Oh, no. Muslims never do that, do they? All right, I'll continue reading the article. In addition, Press TV reported that the fresh plot by terrorists to target churches is an organized Zionist scenario aimed at creating a rift between Muslims and Christians. Christians are expressing fear. The attack marks a widening of attacks by radical Islamists, which have increased dramatically in Iraq. Dozens of people were killed after terrorists took more than 120 Christians hostage in a Baghdad Catholic church in late October. I just read to you from the Jerusalem Post, 1-4-11. Now, ironically, even those who would dismiss this Zionist plot proposed scenario as something straight out of Joseph Goebbels' bag of tricks still tend to blame Israel themselves in general for Islamic violence. As the story goes, Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine and America's tendency to take Israel's side inspires Muslim violence around the world. Yeah, that must be it. The treatment of Muslim nations toward its Christian population is directly linked to Israel. All terrorism put aside, Islam is the official religion of Egypt, and religious practices that defy Islamic law are outlawed there. Exactly what this has to do with Israel, I'm sure I don't know. But conventional wisdom insists that it's still somehow linked to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. In all fairness to Egypt, her laws pale by comparison to America's ally, Saudi Arabia, who forbids the construction of church buildings, outlaws the Bible, and executes any Muslim who converts to Christianity or other religions. Looking at the Saudi situation ought to make us madder than ever at Israel. And then there's Kuwait, where religions not endorsed in the Quran are forbidden, or Algeria, where public assembly is restricted to the religion of Islam. Oh, how about that sweetheart Syria, where it is against the law for Christians to share their faith, or the Sudan, where conversion to any religion other than Islam is met with death. Time does not permit me to discuss Qatar or Malaysia, but rest assured, any problem these countries have with Christianity is really a problem with Israel. On the other hand, perhaps we can consider that one of the greatest dilemmas of the 21st century actually has nothing to do with Jews, other than the fact that the Quran makes disparaging remarks against Jews and Christians alike, forbidding Muslims to even be their friends. Let me read from the Quran. Believers, take neither the Jews nor the Christians for your friends. They are friends with one another. Whoever of you seeks their friendship will become one of their number. God does not guide the wrongdoers. That was from Surah 5. This same Quran commands Muslims to wage war against any who will not convert to Islam. Prophet, make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them. That's from Surah 9. Now, while many peaceful Muslims reinterpret such passages and renounce violence, the words still exist and are considered by many to be sacred scripture. Nothing is being accomplished by pretending otherwise or by using Israel as a scapegoat. Make no mistake, the problem Muslim countries have with Israel is the same problem they have with their own Christian populations. Non-Muslim nations are not being tolerated, period. On to other news when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Although it has become fashionable for liberals to challenge right-wing hate speech with their patronizing pleas to tone down the rhetoric and their microscopic ability to examine their own verbal ammunition, the discussion certainly reached an all-time low following Arizona's fatal shootings. Now, we spent a lot of time talking about that last week, but I want to bring up one that we didn't get to last week, because this one's my favorite. Quick to add his personal spin on recent history, Bill Maher received quite the surprise while appearing on The Tonight Show. This time, Television's hip crowd did not seem to appreciate Marr's clever willingness to associate conservatives with violence. Marr said the right-wing legend, they quote him, using incorrect grammar here, but I'm reading the quote exactly. The right wing loves the go-to rhetoric for them is, wouldn't it be fun to kill the people we disagree with? Now, when members of the audience started booing, Mayer asked them if they ever read. Such arrogance is par for the course with this smug celebrity, and his personal track record of designating those who disagree with him as nothing but a pack of morons. One cannot help but think of another recent shooting, the Pentagon incident, remember? Bill Maher, in the middle of a stand-up routine, commenting on how the perpetrator was gunned down, said, why couldn't this have been Glenn Beck? Call me a romantic, but Mayer seemed to be having fun with the idea of Beck's death. Yes, I do understand. I understand the brilliant artistic wit was in the middle of a comedy monologue. He did not intend for his well-written oratory to be taken as a literal call to violence, but then we conservatives are not the ones who need to be convinced that lone gunmen, rather than the words they may be exposed to, are responsible for their own actions. If Maher really wants to go through this door, he'd be well advised to look both ways first, to the left as well as the right. Well, of course, you can reach us by phone or by internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. As a general rule, I treat people with respect on this program, even when they disagree with me. Unfortunately, those who write email comments are not always as careful with their words. It's easy for people to posture over the internet when they don't have to talk to you or look you in the eye. And I must say, some of today's comments are absolutely vile. In such cases, I'm not always as quick to show the usual courtesy. I don't feel a mealy-mouthed reaction helps a rude person. And I think sometimes a rude person needs to be called out. There is a time and a place for different kinds of responses, and that occasionally means a firm one. So I wanted to give you a heads up. I will still try to keep it somewhat on the light side, but I got to tell you, it won't be easy. Now, I do like the first comment, though. I'm not saying I don't like any of these. I like some of this. The first one's kind of tongue-in-cheek, kind of sarcastic, and, ooh, you know, your old pal Bob loves sarcasm. Concerning my comments about the Egyptian bombing and attempts to blame Israel, Pincus writes, the real reason Christians were attacked in Egypt is because there are no more Jews living there. They were expelled in the 1950s after Israel was established. So it kind of is Israel's fault, after all. Hugo says, there would be peace in the world without Israel. Talk to any Muslim, be he Pakistani, Afghani, Malay, Somali, and they all say Israel is the problem because the Jews occupying illegally Palestinian land are descendants of Eastern European converted Jews and have no connection to that land. Furthermore, they have their own autonomous Jewish region in Russia. Hugo, you didn't hear a word I said, did you? Oh, and Hugo, are you familiar with a subject called history? The Jews have been in the Middle East since 2,000 years before Christ. And this autonomous region that they had in Russia didn't work out too well for them. But that would be something else for you to study in history, Hugo. The pogroms where Jews had their homes burnt to the ground and were often forced to move on a moment's notice. And then there was this little event called the Holocaust. Maybe you heard of it. Grouchy, you know, people use a lot of nicknames over the internet. Grouchy says, if we didn't support Israel's right to exist, the Muslim world would find another excuse to hate us. They are not going to like us regardless of our apologies. Grouchy, you said it. And John says, the persecution of Christians has begun. Even in the Western world, where government suppresses the Christian faith through hate crime laws forcing faith-based hospitals to go against their beliefs or get out of the business, removing Christian symbols and abolishing prayer or mention of Jesus at public events, eventually violence will be upon us for our faith as more and more turn from God and become atheists who are hateful and angry towards religion. I don't think all atheists are hateful, but I do understand the spirit of what John's saying. John continues, TV and movies that mock Christianity are approved of as well, but hold your heads high and get ready to suffer for the name, as it's already been foretold, the victory and end is already ours. Now, here are some comments about my Washington Times column about Bill Maher. I gave you the oral version of it on the radio. This one is from Deja Vu. Mayer made a bad joke with the Beck deal, but it's a far cry in reach to compare his remarks to the comments and opinions heard every day from such nuts, far-right nuts as Palin, O'Reilly, Beck, etc. Don't you conservatives get it? When you lose elections and voters, fix what is wrong in your party. We didn't lose the last election, Deja Vu. Don't you get it? Anyway, I'll continue reading. Fix what's wrong with your party and find instead the common ground to work with the Obama administration. I'd love to find some common ground with Obama, my friend, if there were any common ground. Then he says, using crosshairs and lock and load. See, the only thing he has against the right is that they use figures of speech like crosshairs and lock and load to describe the strategy and hiding behind the American flag. God and country is getting old. Your party is truly saturated with alarmingly disturbing beliefs. I just want to say for the record, I am part of the Tea Party and I'm a Democrat. So I don't know what he thinks he's talking about. Well, I know what he thinks he's talking about when he says party. He's assuming everybody in the Tea Party are Republicans. There are Democrats and independents in the Tea Party. But I'll continue reading these comments anyway. He says, remember, none of you ever complained while the Bush administration and Cheney were looting a surplus, dismantling the Constitution and our Bill of Rights. There was so much damage done, we will never recover financially and morally. They headed us in the direction of becoming a third world country. And the far right and conservatives want to sing the same old song, never mind the damage. Truth is, most of you cannot get over the fact that we have a black president. So let's tear down any politician who is Democrat or not of like opinion. That's what is bothering the Tea Party and conservatives. Oh, the issue is that Obama is black? It can't possibly be his socialist agenda or his attempts to limit free speech or his gutless foreign policy. Most of us object to Obama only because he is black, and you know this for a fact. How exactly? Have you met most of us? Have you met any of us? Are you a mind reader? Are you aware of the Black Tea Party movement? What a thoughtless, irresponsible statement. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. And when conservatives were defending Condoleezza Rice or Clarence Thomas against vicious attacks from the left, where were you, my friend? Calling the liberals racist? I doubt it. You don't seem to do very well with politics. Maybe you should take up another skill like leather craft. This one is from Aristius. He says, oh, I know who Marr is, but who is this Siegel person? And does Marr give a rat's patootie who this Siegel person is? The next one's even better. This one is from Aquila. Marr must be doing something right. He has begun his ninth multi-million dollar season with HBO and has been signed to a new contract that ups his shows to 32 per year. He has also been booked for 9 solo specials for this year. Go out on the streets of America and ask 1,000 people if they have heard of Bill Maher and Bob Siegel. The results would be very easy to imagine. Whether one likes or dislikes Maher is irrelevant to anything. Siegel is nothing but a tiny, insignificant little ankle nipper in comparison. Well, this ankle nipper will be right back. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I was reading some comments to the Washington Times article version of the monologue I gave early in the program about Bill Maher. And I read two comments before we went to the break, one from Aristius and one from Aquila. And their points were that Maher is famous and people have heard of him, and who is Bob Siegel? Now, I hope everybody is following the brilliant logic of these two gentlemen. Truth is not determined by the points people make or the facts they use to back up their assertions. It's only a matter of who is more famous or popular. Of course, it's also clear now. Well, okay then. By this reckoning, have you ever compared the ratings of Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck to HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher? It's a joke. The ratings don't even show up in the same stratosphere. So according to our clear-thinking intellectual friends, Limbaugh and Beck, by nature of their ratings, must be correct in everything they say, and Maher speaks falsehood because of his lower ratings. Thanks for your comments, guys. They were quite entertaining. Oh, just a friendly suggestion. Next time you might want to think for a second before speaking. You'd be surprised what a difference it might make. Fortunately, one of my other readers also caught their moral and logical bankruptcy. Greg says, funny how quickly we can fall into ad hominem, arguing, attacking a person's character, whether it be Maher or Siegel. I believe the original point of the article is that Maher made a sweeping accusation. The right wing loves the go-to rhetoric. For them is, wouldn't it be fun to kill the people we disagree with? That, in and of itself, is extreme. But that Maher also seemed to state this as if the left wing or liberal side doesn't do this. Point taken. A good point. As for the character or popularity of an individual, that seems to be a reflection of a combination of the people that follow the person, along with media coverage, right places at right times, and hard work. Yes, hard work. A big following or a small following do not indicate a person's significance or that their ideas and values are correct. It simply shows that they found an audience to listen to them and they're working hard to keep them listening. John says, who listens to any celebrity rant? All of Hollywood is filled with leftists, not dealing with the real world elitist snobs who think they know what's best for everyone. The only fools who watch and support these idiots are little shallow-minded people who are both immature and insecure and filled with hatred. They vote for the cool politician, and they watch degrading TV shows. They accept this fact, whatever spews forth from the media and the entertainment industry. Unfortunately, this has become most of the country under 30. That's kind of chilling. Rubicon says, if we are to consider Bill Maher an example of liberal intellect, then liberals are really losing serious ground. And Evan says, typical liberal hypocrisy. I wouldn't expect anything less from him. Donna says, who watches Leno or Maher? Peter says, Maher is glib, but not intelligent and too clueless to understand the difference. Let's hope Leno permanently disinvites Maher from his show. Maher can always appear on the Letterman show to spew his hateful venom, or maybe he can do a project with Kathy Griffin. And Adams says, we all know that those of Mr. Maher's ilk are so, he's saying this sarcastically, we all know that those of Mr. Maher's ilk are so much smarter and better Americans than those who have a different view of politics and society. I think any intelligent person can look at history and see which side of the political spectrum rioters, bomb throwers, anti-war demonstrators were on, and just how nonviolent their behavior was. I take note of the muted voices when movies about the assassination of George W. Bush were played and he was burned in effigy. But Bert says the Leno crowd is not a hip crowd. That's why they're Leno's crowd. Leno has no edge whatever, though he has picked up slightly since the Conan debacle. But give Leno credit for at least having Maher in his program. Maher gets it wrong sometimes, but he seems to be one of the few public figures with the courage to ask both reasonable and out-of-the-box questions in the face of herd mentality and lowest common denominator, which all of the mainstream media has embraced with fervor since the first Gulf War. Bert, what color is the sky in your world? Maher is out of the box. He thinks out of the box. Bill Maher goes against the mainstream media. Name one major viewpoint or ideology of Maher, from religion to healthcare to his comments about conservatives, which differ from the mainstream media in any way. And Deb from Facebook says, I appreciate your well-written article, Bob. Thank you. I thought Maher got off pretty easy, considering how vile his statements were. But it was good to hear the audience respond as they did. Jim says, bravo, Bob. You are a calm oasis of logic in the desert of celebrity-driven politics. And I'm reading this full name because he gave his full name. It's Richard Ryder, chairman of the San Diego Firefighters. He says, I've just completed a long exchange of comments on Facebook with a lefty that thinks the right-wing violence speak is far more prevalent than the left wing. It caused me to do some research on the internet, and you might find the results interesting. As expected, it's the left-wing politicians and luminaries from Obama on down that provide most of the supposed violence speak, and the left-wing attacks are on their GOP political opponents. Well, the best my internet adversary could come up with were right-wing references to the Civil War and hostile comments by Republicans against terrorists and convicted murderers. I may put this together as a blog item, but in the meantime, it's posted on my Facebook page. Thank you, sir. Alger says, well said. It is important that everyone try to tone down the personal rhetoric, not because this tragic incident was in any way caused by the hate speech. It clearly wasn't, but because the rhetoric is counterproductive to being able to have the vigorous policy debates that are necessary to keep our country strong. Now, regarding my comments that I made on last week's radio show with the Arizona shooting, Amorpheus says, Sheriff Dupnik is absolutely right when he says that right-wing media is broadcasting a constant message that provokes mentally unstable people to react in aggressive and sometimes dangerous ways. His experience in seeing the ugly reality of the world most people avoid gives him a clear understanding of the consequences of the rhetoric of today's policies. Really, well, Sheriff Dupnik said that before anybody found out anything about the guy. Turned out the guy was not associated with the Tea Party, is not a Republican. He's a registered Democrat. He owns a copy of the Communist Manifesto. He's from the left. He's not from the right. He's probably just a nutcase who doesn't believe in the left or the right. Amorpheus, my friend. Dupnik's inflammatory language makes him guilty of the very thing he speaks out against. And the fact that he made that conclusion prematurely as a sheriff of all people who had no facts, absolutely disgraceful. Well, Glamis says the vitriol from O'Reilly, Beck, and Rush has been unacceptable for the last few years. And as usual, comments such as these provide zero examples. Oh, that's right. It's only because they have no such examples. This next guy calls himself Truth Sayer. You're going to love the words of truth that come from Truth Sayer. He says, what this does is now force the Tea Party movement to move to more civil discourse and less violent doomsday pick up your guns imagery. And in this new contest, what will hopefully be a contest of actual ideas for moving forward, I am confident that the Tea Party movement will be shown as the political frauds they are. My only question is that when faced with the reality that their ideas do not hold up and their base cannot be energized without inflamed rhetoric, will they return to the violent rhetoric that got them where they are today? Will they feel they have to rely on inciting people to almost open armed rebellion once more? Well, I must say that if they do, it is my hope that the moderates and liberals alike can come together not only to call them out for this return, but to also shun them politically as well. I'll read more from Truth Sayer and give you my reactions to his truth when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. I'm reading some comments from Truth Sayer, responding to some of my comments on last week's show about people trying to blame rhetoric for the shooting in Arizona. This guy's blaming it all on the Tea Party. He says, now moving forward, those against the Tea Party movement would best serve that cause by winning the contest of ideas, by espousing quality political plans that look forward and give hope to a prosperous future. It is my hypothesis that the Tea Party movement cannot stand on such ideas, as they do not have any, and that the best way to ensure they fade away is to force them to stand on ideas and not violent rhetoric. My friend, I have been very involved with the Tea Party movement, and I doubt that you have ever attended even one single such event because the charges you make are simply untrue. Maybe you should stop repeating what you hear about the Tea Party and learn to think for yourself. And some Facebook comments. Maureen says Dupnik should be fired. Deborah says, in relation to this tragic event, it seems there's more than the usual amount of distorted thinking. It's worrying. Regarding what I said last week about healthcare, Anne on Facebook says, I agree, Bob. The Dems passed that healthcare mandate without the pleasure of the people, a phrase so many are fond of using. Let's see. Average Americans from all parties went out to vote and have their voices heard. Oh, right. The Dems should do as they please with their majority. And then when they lose it with a resounding message, they are to go forward continuing to not listen. Ah, repeal that thing and don't invent a mandate to purchase a product. That may save some jobs, too. Regarding my comments about the fairness doctrine and Obama's attempts to take over the internet that I made last week, this fellow calls himself Proud Texan. He says, and he's responding to the literary version of this that I put up on the Washington Times. Proud Texan says, thank you for this right-wing propaganda piece. It's exactly articles like this which surrender any remaining conservatives' credibility. Well, my friend, as usual, these brilliant liberal critiques come without responding to a single fact I listed, and I listed many of them in the article. It was just dripping with facts and data and quotes. But okay, I have a response for you anyway. At least we conservatives are not trying to forbid the speech of our opponents. For example, I just read your words over the air, words you can be quite proud of, Proud Texan. J. Paul Douglas liked my article a little more than Proud Texan. He says, this article is right on target. Obama has demonstrated over and over his determination to get what he wants one way or another. He couldn't get health care through the Congress, so he, through his henchmen, simply circumvented the Senate by deeming the bill passed, never mind Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution. If you can't get past it, go around it. And this is precisely the strategy he will use in every other goal he has, this one included. If you have difficulty with the fairness doctrine, just call it something else and or get it through some other doorway. Example, net neutrality. Obama is the worst villain of our time. And then Tony writes, as I recall, the Nazis stifled freedom in speech. Also, better not say that, Tony. Better tone down the rhetoric. Let me tell you where I am with this rhetoric. And I said this yesterday at a tea party, so I'm guilty on two accounts. Toned up rhetoric is not a problem unless the rhetoric happens to be false. If we're speaking the truth, I hope we do say it in some electrically charged way so that people will pay attention to it. Now, this next letter is from Ryan, and it brings us back to the subject we raised at the top of the program. Ryan says, I am currently in my third year at San Diego State, and I took a general ed class on American Indian history. I liked the professor because he was a very nice guy and was very funny, but he was very much a secularist. He constantly made fun of religion and made it very evident that religion, and more specifically Catholicism and Christianity, are wrong, and people that were religious were unintelligent. See, it's okay for people to say those things about Christians, but when Christians and conservatives critique everybody, we got to tone down the rhetoric. Anyway, this professor said they were wrong. People that were religious were unintelligent, closed-minded. He is an archaeologist, and so one of the questions I had was about the carbon dating that scientists use. By the way, folks, archaeology confirms the Bible all the time. All the time. But let me continue here. He kept bringing up that Christians believe the world is only 10,000 years old, but the carbon dating says billions and so on and so forth, and that the carbon dating system is 100% factual. And so if you believe otherwise, you are brainwashed. How do Christians combat the carbon dating system? And my last question was that my professor said that if you believe in Christianity and the moral laws of Christianity, then you are a hypocrite because the only way that life could have been started is that Adam and Eve's family practiced incest. He seemed to bring up these types of debatable questions every day, but these were the two that most intrigued me. Thank you for your time. Sincerely, Ryan. Well, thank you for the question, Ryan. As for the age of the earth, not all Christians believe in a young earth. More about that in a moment. As for Adam and Eve, we must remember that incest became a problem far later in the gene pool. Obviously, the world had to be populated, and in the beginning, Adam and Eve were given the command to reproduce before they even fell into sin and before mortality. It was a completely different kind of human race, entirely different situation at that time. As for Genesis specifically and in more detail, well, here's a related question. And this question says, even if I wanted to accept part of the Bible, namely the life of Jesus Christ, must I also accept the Genesis account? This seems like a fairy tale. Okay, I was not raised as a Christian or Bible believer, and for that reason, the creation account of the Bible always seemed like a fairy tale to me too. That is, it seemed that way until I sat down without any preconceived bias and really thought about it. I submit that the Genesis account makes far more sense than we give it credit for. But let's put that idea on hold for a moment as I respond to another part of the question. Can we accept parts of the Bible and not all of the Bible? Well, what does the Bible itself say about the Bible? In 2 Timothy 3:16 through 17, it says, all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness so that the man of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. Jesus himself believed the entire Old Testament was the Word of God. In those days, they did not call it the Old Testament because they were not expecting any New Testament. It was called the Law and the Prophets. This is what Jesus said about the Law and the Prophets in Matthew 5. Do not think that I have come to abolish the Law or the Prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Now, although this sweeping endorsement of the entire Bible should end the discussion, it may still be of interest to point out that Jesus specifically referred to some of the most disputed Old Testament narratives, such as the story of Noah. He mentioned Noah in Matthew 24, the story of Jonah. He mentioned Jonah in Matthew 12. He also referred to the death of Abel in Matthew 23 and even quoted from Genesis chapter 1, directly, I'm reading that from Mark 10. They said, in talking to Jesus, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. It was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law, Jesus replied. But at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. And he's quoting now directly out of Genesis. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. The Apostle Paul also authenticates Adam in detail and name the entire doctrine of our sin nature, crucial to an understanding of what Jesus did for us on the cross, is explained by Paul, and we'll read what he says when we return. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Just what's so illogical about the book of Genesis anyway, and can one accept parts of the Bible without accepting all of the Bible, or must we accept the whole kit and caboodle? Well, Jesus quoted from Genesis, he referred to Adam and Eve, he referred to Noah, and the Apostle Paul, and as he developed the doctrine of our sin nature, started it with Adam and Eve. I'm reading from Romans 5:14. Paul says, "Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses." See, Paul's talking about Adam as a person who really lived. "Even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who was a pattern of the one to come." 1 Corinthians 15, he mentions him again. "So it was written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, the last Adam, a life-giving spirit." And he mentions him in 1 Timothy chapter 2. "For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner." Folks, rest assured, one cannot accept the Bible without accepting the Genesis account. Now then, as for Genesis seeming like a fairy tale, allow me to pose a simple question. Exactly what is it about the story that looks illogical? We are told that God created human beings from the dust of the ground. No detail is given as to how God did it, just that he did. Every mineral in the human body can be found in the ground. The rest of the human body is made up of water. Well, how about a snake talking? Well, that creature is identified in the book of Revelation as Satan. Serpent is not the snake-like creature we are familiar with, although that creature undoubtedly got its name from the description of Satan, where they poetically talked about how he'd fall on his belly. And since such a description is part of the oldest story handed down to human beings, Satan is an intelligent creature alien to this world, which exists at the moment in another dimension. The idea of life from other worlds may still seem hard to fathom, but it is not beyond the range of possibility, and there's nothing inherently irrational about accepting such a notion. But Bob, isn't the Genesis account contradicted by the theory of evolution? Well, if you're calling it a theory, you are correct when you're calling it a theory. That's all it is, and many scientists do not accept evolution. That is, they do not accept macroevolution. Microevolution is accepted even by Christian creationists. There is ample observation that within its own species, life does evolve. But evolution from one species to another has never been observed. Neither do we have any fossils showing such missing links. There are a couple of alleged ones, but they're disputed even by scientists who accept evolution, and they're very few. We ought to be seeing millions and millions of these missing links if all life was once related. Now, can one believe in evolution and God at the same time? Many people do. They do. They are called theistic evolutionists. Think about it. If things really are evolving from a lower order to a higher order, that would be a pretty incredible miracle. It is evolution apart from God that any thinking person should question. Now, while on the subject of fairy tales, you remember the one about the frog who became a handsome prince? Well, you give a frog to an evolutionist, and after a billion years or so, that frog will become a handsome prince too. Evolution through randomness and chance makes about as much sense as imagining a computer or any other machine coming into existence without a plan or blueprint. The human body is far more complicated than any machine we have built. It is beautiful, too. This suggests that it was created by a master scientist and master artist. Hypothetically, he could have done this through evolution. Now, although not a Christian by any means, Albert Einstein is nevertheless an example of a man who accepted both evolution and some kind of God. I'm quoting from Einstein. "Everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble." I got that from a book called The Quotable Einstein, from one of Einstein's letters. And even the big granddaddy of evolution was not setting out to disprove God's existence. Charles Darwin still believed in God when he wrote The Origin of Species. Now, it is true that late in life, Darwin had many doubts about the God of the Bible and considered himself to be an agnostic. This belief, however, still maintained that some kind of God might exist. Darwin stopped being a Christian partly because of the death of his daughter and not because of the theory of evolution alone. Now, although I myself do not believe in the theory of evolution, it should still be pointed out that Genesis was not written as a science book, but rather as a history of the people of Israel. The book of Genesis is 50 chapters in length. Only the first three chapters talk about the creation of the world and the fall of human beings into sin. This tells us something about the priority of the writer. He was obviously giving a quick review of an oral tradition already known to the people. "I would gladly trade 20 chapters of Leviticus for more information on how God created the world, but we must accept Genesis as it was written. Only when Abraham comes on the scene in chapter 12 does the narrative slow down and provide intricate detail. At that time, we learn about Abraham's money and livestock, even his sex life. Genesis is a history of Abraham's people and a prologue for the rest of the Torah, Torah meaning Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Genesis is to the story of Moses what the Hobbit is to the Lord of the Rings. We conclude that specifics about creation were not the writer's intention. The first chapter of Genesis is written in a style of writing known as Hebrew poetry. It is not seeking to give any kind of order to creation, as evidenced by the fact that the world exists with water and vegetation prior to the creation of the sun. The word for day, yom, is a Hebrew word that did not have to mean a literal 24-hour day, but could also be referring to an event. This poem, then, could simply be God's way of discussing different events in the stages of creation. But Bob, does this mean that one can accept Genesis without accepting a literal six-day account? Let me answer this question as carefully as I can. First of all, I have no problem with God's abilities here. He could have created the earth in 6 days. He could have created the earth in 6 seconds, as far as I'm concerned. I am not a scientist and not the best person to debate the questions associated with geology. I have had the pleasure of meeting several people from the Institute for Creation Research. They give some compelling arguments for a young earth and a literal 6-day account. I think everybody should hear them out and ponder what they have to say. Still, for myself, I tend to think of it a little differently. The Bible portrays God as being completely removed from time. Time is a human limitation. When we ask whether it took God 6 days or 6 million years to create the world, the question is irrelevant. In fact, it took God no amount of time at all to create the world because God does not exist in time. To speak at our level, God is using language we will relate to. Since we live in time and space, it is possible that a very long process over the years, as we understand years, created the world and slowly brought about different forms of life. Genesis, then, leaves room for the theory of evolution, or perhaps a better theory. I personally would put my emphasis on the words, perhaps a better theory. But for now, belief in an old earth along with Darwin's theories do not contradict the Bible in any way. But Bob, there are other things about this story that do not make sense. For example, Cain, when banished by God, was fearful of all the people he would encounter. Where did these people come from if Cain was the third human being? Well, I do not believe Cain was the first child of Eve. I believe he was the first child of Eve born mortal. When the Bible says that Adam was 800 years old, the reckoning may have begun after his fall into sin. Chances are none of his days in the Garden of Eden would have been counted because he was not living a mortal life in Eden. Eden was somehow connected to heaven and eternity. Who knows how long Adam and Eve were in the garden by our reckoning of time? It could have been thousands of years. It could have been millions of years. What we do know is that while in Eden, he and Eve were given the command to procreate. And there is no reason to think they did not obey this command. It takes 5 minutes to read the first 3 chapters of Genesis, but people, that does not mean Adam and Eve were only in the garden for 5 minutes. As a matter of fact, an entire community of people, their children, may have been banished from the garden right along with them after the fall into sin. But there is another element to the creation narrative, namely that it explains the world around us. Genesis is the story of how man lost paradise, and this is the exact picture we see today. Paul describes the picture as follows in Romans chapter 8. The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed, for the creation was subjected to frustration not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. People, on one hand, life around this is a paradise, but this paradise has been invaded. In nature, we see sunsets, seashores, and snow-capped mountains, but we also see earthquakes, hurricanes, tidal waves, disease. This dichotomy is also apparent in human nature. Humans are capable of music, poetry, and love. There's nothing like the love of a man for a woman or the love of a mother for her children, and those who have friends feel a warmth and fellowship that makes them grateful to not be alone. But human beings are also capable of crime, racism, murder, rape, and all kinds of other horrors. Both the nature of the world and the nature of human beings appear to be invaded by evil. We can dismiss the Garden of Eden narrative if we wish, but while speculating as to why a loving God would have allowed his creation to turn so sick, we would be forced to suggest something similar Anyway, human beings were once a part of paradise, but they did not appreciate it. The original humans were curious to know what evil was, and they found out. I will see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.